Coming up, it's another episode of Breakfast with the Beats from the Pitcherless Podcast Network. First, Mike and I talk about the teams we would want to stream pitchers against over the final month of the season. Then we go over Jacob deGrom's struggles, George Klaassen's potential, and the Triple Crown possibilities of Yordan Alvarez. After that, Mike and I take a different approach when it comes to topics to discuss, as we take different sides of the following things. Where to take a starting pitcher in drafts, the potential of O'Neill Cruz, when it's okay to draft your first closer, and whether or not guys like Xavier Edwards and Chandler Simpson have a place in the world of fantasy baseball. And let's put it this way. I have a real Chandler Simpson problem that won't go away anytime soon. Finally, in our mental health moment, we talk about how we handle disagreements in our everyday lives and what we can do better. All this and more in this episode of Breakfast with the Beats. But first, a quick word.
Good morning, fantasy baseball fans. It's your old pal Mike Carter here joining you outside of Chicago on a cooler, very humid morning, but I have a sweatshirt on and feels like fall might be coming until my wife notified me last night that a string of 90-degree weather is coming, which we refer to here as corn sweats. We refer to here as not good fat guy weather. So, you know, your old pal Mike is going to be having some trouble in the next couple of weeks. We're heading into the end of the month of August here. Kids are back in school. Dave's getting ready to go back to school here in a week or so. And summer is coming to an end, but we still have a lot of baseball to talk about. Mm-hmm. Dave, good morning. Happy Saturday. It's the first time we've recorded on a Saturday in a little while.
It's been a while. You and I have both been busy, but here we are, Saturday morning. I'm getting ready for my corn sweats up here. I got some corn deodorant. I don't know if that, does that help out? The corn Man, sweats?
That might be the most disgusting thing you've ever said to me.
Corn deodorant.
Can you imagine?
There's a market for it though, right? There's got to be like.
I bet you in Iowa there is.
Shark Tank.
Maybe Wisconsin. Shark Tank. Yeah, we're two fantasy baseball idiots who do a podcast that like three people listen to. But we have a great idea for a product, Mark Cuban. Listen
you
to us, please.
You take your cob of corn and you just.
Yeah. We also have a butter flavor. All right. Enough.
Butter flavored corn
deodorant. Oh, boy. Let's hope the caffeine kicks in here pretty soon for both of us. I'm both a little slap happy this morning. God. It was our first full week with the students here this week, so I'm feeling a little draggy this morning. So, all right. I did put deodorant on this morning. It was not corn cob deodorant. It was just a general, regular Old Spice for anybody who's wondering or anybody who cares. I'm all alone in my office. There's not a human being near me. So let's roll. Dave, getting back on focus here.
Yeah.
Now that you've stopped crying with your cracking yourself up so much with your own laughter. We have a chart here that we're taking a look at that you and I have been looking at this morning that talks about team batting averages since the trade deadline. And there are some really pitiful team batting averages since the trade deadline. And we know that teams make changes at the trade deadline. They trade guys that were big contributors to their bottom line, and they replace them sometimes with guys that are maybe not as good or maybe guys that are trying to make a mark and get some runway in the major leagues. But the question that I wanted to start off with this show, Episode 21, by the way, is which of the following teams would you feel comfortable starting a borderline streamer against over the final month of the season? So we're in streaming season, right? I mean, a lot of people are doing that as a strategy in their fantasy leagues. Of the 30 major league teams, what's one team that you would be targeting to stream against?
I looking at those totals, there's some really bad numbers at the bottom there. But for me, near the bottom, I'd actually go against the Reds.
Good choice.
I feel like they've given up. When you put Eugenio Suarez and TJ Friedl on waivers, I think that's a clear white flag of we are done with this season. We just want to move on. And I feel like in that lineup, if you can get past Ellie De La Cruz and Sal Stewart, there really isn't much left. Their remaining schedule is a bit odd too. So they're at home to San Diego and Milwaukee, and then they travel out west to the Dodgers. And then straight from there, they go right back to Milwaukee. It's a lot of travel. before they face the Dodgers again, the Cubs, and then they're at Atlanta and Toronto. So they're all over the place. They're going to have a tough travel schedule there. And if you're on the fence or you're looking for someone to stream against a bad team, they strike out a lot. And why not take a chance on a team that's playing for next year with a lot of unproven players? I'd go against the Reds.
Yeah, when you take a look at that lineup, Dave, I think you're right on target. I mean, they're besides Ellie and Sal Stewart and JJ Bleday, I guess every once in a while is okay. You're facing the likes of Hector Rodriguez, Dane Myers, Edwin Arroyo, Matt McClain, who looks like me swinging a baseball bat right now. Not a good look. I think that you're right on target, and that's a good team to stream against. Actually, Matt McClain has been so bad this year that I think he might be eating the corn cob deodorant instead of putting it on his body. The team that I chose here is kind of in that same boat. I got home last night. Katie and I had dinner out last night, and I got home and put the late game on, and I was watching the Giants and the Diamondbacks, and the Giants are absolutely putrid. Their lineup is absolutely just beyond repair at this point. I mean, I know they got Bryce Eldridge back, but once you get past Devers and Eldridge, there's really not much there. I mean, the regular lineup right now, according to Roster Resource against righties, is Drew Gilbert, Rafael Devers, Bryce Eldridge, Jung Hoo Lee, batting cleanup. Ouch. Then somebody named Turner Hill, Shea Whitcomb, who's, I think, on his second organization of the year, Drew Kavanaugh, Christian Koss, and Nate Furman.
Yeah.
Does that strike fear into you, David?
I'm not a Giants fan, but if I was, it would strike fear into me because I don't know what the team is doing. That's not looking good at all.
And then you look at a little more deeply, and it doesn't get any better. I mean, besides Logan Webb, they're starting Landon Roop, Blade Tidwell, Anthony Molina in their rotation, and Dylan Smith is allegedly their closer, although I think Jason Foley might track him down, which isn't really any better. But yeah, I would be streaming against the Giants. I don't see anything in that lineup that makes me super fearful at this point.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good call. I mean, they faced the Dodgers twice. They faced the Cardinals twice to end the season. The Mets, the Pirates. It's there's some opportunities there to maybe stream one or two pitchers against them and take advantage of a team that is just clueless.
I really am interested to see what they do there in the wintertime because, there was a really good article in The Athletic a couple of weeks ago that I shared with you that was a kind of an expose of Buster Posey. And, he's really firmly in the target right now, the crosshairs of the target, I should say, with how terrible this team has performed since he has taken over. Although a lot of people did give them credit for how they rebuilt the farm system with some of the trades at the trade deadline. So I guess we'll have to see how that goes. But I hope Buster Posey doesn't ruin his legacy by taking over the team that he dominated.
Well, the hard part for them is they have so much money under contract next year with older players like Harrison Bader's under contract. Logan, you need him. But Matt Chapman's under contract. Willie, these guys are all approaching or at 30 or higher. And it's just, how do you rebuild when most of your team contracts go out to older players?
Yeah. The only way that you'd be able to do it, I think, really is to eat some of that contract and trades to be able to get better prospects back. But even then, what is somebody giving you for Matt Chapman?
Yeah.
They're taking out a lot of salary. They're not getting a lot of bang for their buck. I don't know. I guess that's a conversation for the winter. We'll talk about it then. All right, Dave, let's shift over to our beat writer roundup, which is kind of our bread and butter segment that we do on our show every week. And I like the article that you picked here first because you and I were talking about this game as I was watching this game. And it was by Kennedy Landry talking a little bit about Jacob DeGrom and some of the struggles that he's had in the season's second half. He pitched against my beloved White Sox this week, and they shelled him. He gave up 6 runs in the first inning. He did settle down a little bit after that and was able to get through about 4 innings. But I think he threw 40 pitches in the first inning. Command was a real issue for him in that game. But talk a little bit about the article that Landry wrote about DeGrom, because it's a bigger scope than just my beloved White Sox.
Yeah, it's something big here. So it's called Tonight's on Me, DeGrom Allows Most Runs Since 2017. And basically, it just talked about how frustrated he is with himself. He said, quote, I have to do a better job. Tonight's on me. So it's good that a player is actually taking accountability because you don't always see that. It talked about the first inning and how the White Sox got to him. It was 6 earned runs, 6 batters before even an out, and 42 pitches. They said the 42 pitches that he threw was the second career high since 2018, and the 6 runs allowed was the most that he allowed in one inning since 2017. So Schumacher gave it up for the White Sox, said they showed patience and they weren't swinging and missing. Which is great. It's something that, you know, they had an attack plan on DeGrom and they weren't chasing anything. What was interesting, though, is that there was not even one whiff on the slider. And that's the first time that's happened since 2021. That's something that he really, really relies on. The concerning numbers for DeGrom right now, 6.67 ERA over his last 7 starts, which spans almost 30 innings. He's got 4 games with 4 or more runs earned, which is something he didn't do from 2020 to 2025. What's really concerning, too, is that he's in the 8th percentile for hard hit percentage. That's terrible. He's not getting ground balls at all. He's giving up hard contact, all while the velocity is fine. So it's a really weird and somewhat scary combination of what's happening here. He just turned 38 years old and he's got an overall wear and tear on his arm. It's a huge, extensive injury history for him. Overall, though, he is a 4.21 ERA and a 1.19 whip. And honestly, in the offseason, that's kind of what I look for in players. I look for players that have higher ERAs but low whips. Mm-hmm. Could speak to bad luck. It could be something else altogether, but it shows that the potential is still there. Mm-hmm. Now, a reminder that he had a glute injury earlier, and he did suffer from triceps fatigue earlier this year. With all that being said, it's going to be really tough to start him, not just this season, but I think going forward, because I know like next year, because he may not be, I don't think he is that SP1, SP2, and maybe even an SP3 anymore. I think given in his age and what's been going on with his injuries, he's more like an SP4. And it's just an overall downward trend here that's kind of sad to see for someone who's done it for so long.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you point that out because there are some things here that are troubling to see. I mean, I think the game that I was watching, the thing that I was really struck by was that the velocity was clearly there, but the command was not. He could not put it where he wanted to put it, and he was visibly frustrated that he wasn't able to do that. And he kept looking down at the mound as if there was something wrong with the mound and like his foot was sticking or something. You know, he's a big man. He's 6'4", big guy. But, you know, if you look at some of the underlying stuff here, there will be people that will still bid on DeGrom. But I think what you're absolutely right on target about is where he ranks for next year. I mean, if you're drafting him to be ace 1A or 1B and pairing him with other people, I think that ship has sailed, my friends. Is he still somebody that's usable when he's healthy? Yes, I would absolutely say that would be the case. His expected ERA is half a run lower at 3.67 as opposed to the 4.21 that you pointed out. So there appears to be some bad luck here, but the hard hit percentage isn't bad luck. That's him. The way that the ball's getting hit off of him, that's his issue. Can he go back to the well and maybe think a little bit differently about his pitch mix? You know, I mean, he's thrown the fastball slider for a really long time. Is there a possibility that he adds something else back into that repertoire that changes, you know, the way he goes about his business? You know, he does throw the changeup a lot to lefties, but he doesn't throw it at all to right-handed hitters. You know, maybe there's something he can do to mix that in. At 38 and relying on velocity, this feels like a ticking time bomb, though, doesn't it?
It really does, and it's something that I think for next year I'm willing to give him a chance for, but only late in drafts, because there's a chance that it could just be a you know, I've had all this time off and now I start off strong. And he does what he did this year. He had a pretty good first half and then it's just tailed off. But there's also a chance that Father Time, like once Father Time gets to you, there's no turning back. Yeah. And it just, it's that steady decline down. And we could be seeing that as well. So if I can draft him late in drafts where I'm not taking that big of a risk, I'm all for it. But you're right. I think they're going to be drafting him based on name value alone.
Yeah.
And for me, I'd probably be out.
There'll be somebody that'll be optimistic that it was just a blip on the radar screen and they're going to take him in a place where I'm probably going to be taking a hitter and I wouldn't be super comfortable taking him. Although I think that's a whole separate show this winter, Dave, about valuing pitching for next year. Super intrigued.
One quick question though. He's a two-start pitcher this week, I think, versus the Athletics and I think versus the Rays. Would you start him?
Yeah, I probably would have very little choice but to start him if you look at how crappy my rotations are. Mm. If I had him anywhere. I don't have one share of DeGrom this year.
I don't either. No.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's see what happens next year. I mean, I think your SP4 thing is, well, that's interesting. I was thinking more like 3, but I could see your argument there. I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, 3 or 4.
Okay, let's shift to another article here. This is a guy I wrote about this morning in my SP waiver wire piece. So I'm interested to have a conversation with you about him. You have an article from our talented writer friend, Rhett Bollinger, here about George Klassen. George Klassen is a right-handed pitcher for the Los Angeles Angels. For those of you that are not following very closely at this point or maybe getting ready for football, but he's recently been recalled and he's put up some interesting numbers in Los Angeles. Dave, talk a little bit about this high-profile prospect.
So the article is called Rookie Klassen Learns Important Lesson in Limiting Damage. And it just talks about his latest start. And it was following up a one-hitter versus Houston. Mm-hmm. But in this one, he wasn't as effective. He had shaky command. He said not all of his pitches were really working. And only 54 of his 90 pitches thrown were actually for strikes. But he called it a learning lesson. He was trying to pitch with what was working for him, limiting the damages with runners on base. The quote that I liked, he said, "The biggest thing is not to let stuff spiral out of control," Klassen said. "So when something happens, just try to put the foot down and end it here." And I do like that. I like that he wasn't letting, you know, he's young enough and he wasn't letting this one instance get to him. He has that mental fortitude, and that's actually pretty strong. His overall numbers, not so strong though. 19.2% K rate and a 16.8% walk rates. So there are some concerning numbers there this year, but last year he at least had a 27.7% K rate and a 9.7% walk rate. He's also a highly regarded prospect. The team had him high up on their rankings. He had elite stuff in the minors and he just battled control issues. He's got a 70 grade fastball and he's developed a slider, which some scouts were saying was what he actually needed to do. Right now he gets some time with no pressure at all to work out the kinks. As a starter, he's got a 19.4% K rate, an 11.8% walk rate, a 2.25 ERA, and a 1.21 whip. I think for volume alone and for the fact that he's going to get a chance just to work through some of the kinks here, I think he's worth adding if you need a pitcher just to see if there's something where he can take that next step forward and maybe live up to his true potential over the final month.
Yeah, I totally agree. I do look at this a little bit differently. I mean, the walks, yes, are alarming, but his first two starts were two inning jobbers, and he gave up 5 walks in both of those, you know. And so it's very common for young guys to make it to the major leagues and be really shaky in those debuts and be nervous and give up some walks. And to your point, the last couple of starts, he's gone 6 innings, 7 innings, and then he pitched into the 6th inning, going 5 1/3 in his last one. The Houston start was really kind of an eye-opener. He had 7 strikeouts, but it also was 3 walks there. But in his last start, he had 3 strikeouts and 3 walks, pitched into the 6th inning and worked himself out of some trouble. I like the fact that the walks seem to be kind of coming down a little bit. He seems to be getting his footing a little bit. The one drawback that you have here is right now it looks like he's in a 6-man rotation. But at the same time, you know, I would rather, you and I've talked about this a lot, I would rather take a chance on a guy like him than somebody's 6th starter like Seth Lugo or something right that like right now. I'd rather take a shot with Klassen and see if I can get something out of him, especially if I'm in a keeper league and there's a chance that I might be able to hold on to him for next year. I think it's definitely worth rolling the dice and a gamble here to look take a look at him. I like him. Mm-hmm. And I like the fact that he's got some runway. They really, the Angels aren't really playing for anything as usual, and they're just trying to see what they have. And he might make another 3 or 4 starts and really solidify a spot for himself next year in the rotation.
I think that's really when you can find the needle in the haystack, is I guess that's the phrase I was looking for. It's just when teams have nothing to play for except for next year, they'll try different things. People will get opportunities. And I think that's the best way in fantasy to really find that nugget. It's just see those teams, see what they're doing, give them a chance, and maybe they can live up to that potential.
Absolutely. I love that. The last article we wanted to talk about was by Brian McTaggart, and it was talking about some guy named Yordan Alvarez. Have you heard of him?
Right?
Yeah, he's on the Trashtros, as I call them. He's on the Trashtros. He's having an okay year, isn't he?
Not bad.
The question that's really on the table right now with Yordan is he going to win the Triple Crown? And so McTaggart kind of took a deeper dive into what's going on, and the Astros are on a big series and big road trip coming up here. What did you find in that article, Dave?
So for this, it's called Astros Playoff Push, Alvarez's Triple Crown Campaign Roll Through Big Apple. So basically, it was just talking about how Yordan Alvarez, he's going for the Triple Crown, and it tried to lay out, why he may or may not do it. The biggest part of the article that I found was he said that 5 of the Astros' next 6 series, or 16 of the next 19 games, come against teams who are in the playoff chase, which may or may not be entirely bad news for Houston. The Astros are 19-14 against teams currently with a .500 or better record, and 46-52 against teams at or below. In fact, 19 of the Astros' final 31 games come against teams that are currently either in a postseason spot or within 2 games entering Tuesday. So they will play a lot of good teams here. But my whole point here, I wanted to see, do you think that he can win this Triple Crown? So right now he's at a .318 batting average, a .36 home run, and 91 runs batted in. For each category, I want you to tell me if you think that he will win that category. So starting with batting average, just behind him is Chandler Simpson at .309. Yandy Diaz at .302 and Chase DeLauder at .289. How safe do you think he's there?
I think he's pretty safe there.
I think so too. I think he's in a really good lineup, and I think he's got it. He's already 9 points above Chandler Simpson right now.
Yeah, exactly. I don't see that really stopping. And especially with the number of walks that Alvarez gets too, I think that his batting average is going to stay pretty stable.
Yeah. And I mean, the only real test there might be Chandler Simpson, but he's been really great as of late. But I do expect him to maybe take a step back at some point. Okay. For home runs, Junior Caminero, 35, Ben Rice, 35, Pete Alonso, 32. This one's going to be tough.
That one's going to be a tough one, but I think Caminero hits him in bunches. He could have a weekend where he hits 5 home runs, easily. I think that's going to be a tough one for Alvarez to win. Plus, by the way, I don't know if I mentioned this today, but my beloved White Sox have 3 guys that have 28 home runs or more.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
3, eh? Who are they?
Yeah. Colson Montgomery's got 28 now. Vargas has 29, by the way. Miguel Vargas, love. And Murakami's got 29 as well.
Okay, let's add them to this. Do you think any of them can take the home run title?
Probably not. I mean, they'd have to get super hot.
Too
But
far
I, you know,
behind.
Jordan's on the top there. But I of those guys listed there, you know, Caminero is the guy that I think would I would be most afraid of there in terms of, you know, getting there. I think what do you have 45 home runs last year, so he could still hit 8 or 10 more easily.
I could definitely see Caminero. I don't know about Rice. I'm surprised actually he has 35 because it just feels he comes and goes too, like it's just it. And then Pete Alonso, he's been great as of late, but he needed to have a better start to the season to be
Certainly.
taken. Okay. And then for RBIs, Pete Alonso 91, tied with Yordan. Caminero 85 and Ben Rice 83.
Yeah, he's got a pretty good chance to win that one.
So
I
you
think the home runs are going to be the biggest question mark that we have. So he's in it. I mean, he's in the top three for every category that you just mentioned for the Triple Crown.
yeah. So okay, call your shot here. Is Yordan Alvarez going to win the Triple Crown?
No.
No?
I don't think he's going to win it.
Okay, who's going to take him out?
I don't know if
Caminero?
anybody's going to take him out.
Romo?
A crummy left knee might take him out. That's always
Oh yeah.
the issue that I have, you know, there is like you're anticipating that he's going to have another month of health, and that they're going to stay in the fight, which it looks like they will. It's a really hard thing to do to win all three categories. I just think that the chances are greater that he doesn't do it. With the field that's around him than that he does. I will be rooting for him to do it, though. I would love to see that.
What world are we in when you're the down one? I was going to say yes. I'm Davy Downer.
You are Davy Downer, but I'm Mike the realist
The realist. I like
with my
that.
corn cob deodorant. The thing about Alvarez, you know, it was when you put this question on there, I was kind of predisposed right away to say no. And then I took a little bit deeper dive into the numbers and whatnot. And I'm wondering if I'm giving him a bad rap on the injury stuff.
No, you're not.
You don't think so?
No, he gets injured all the time. And I'm surprised that I'm actually in on him given how injury prone he is. But I don't know, it just feels like one of those seasons for him where everything comes together, everything works, and I don't know, I'm gonna ride it. I don't roster him anywhere though. I was too worried about the injuries at the beginning of the season, but I don't know.
But here's the thing. This is why I was saying this, and then this food for thought. If you go back and look at his seasons, in 21, he played 144 games. In 22, he played 135 games. 23, 114. So that's a little down, but he's still at 31 home runs. In 24, he played in 147 games. And last year, he had obviously the knee issues that kept him out. And not as productive as what he would be, but he's among the league leaders this year in games played again at 133. He's fifth in the American League. So I'm wondering if I have maybe unfairly, you know, limited myself in my mind about how good Alvarez is and how good he can be by hiding behind this idea that he's often injured and I want somebody that's not. When in you know four of the last you know four of the last 5 years, he's actually played in enough games to be a productive player for you in fantasy. Maybe I'm wrong.
I don't think you're wrong, given the fact that it's happened multiple times and he's had surgeries and he's had, all the issues. And you weren't the only one. I mean, he was being drafted lower than obviously he should have been. But I think it's important when you have that data in front of you and you have the history of things happening over and over again. I don't think it's unfair to believe or to predict that maybe that will happen again. I think that's more often than not, you're going to be right in the fact that yeah, it did happen again. It's happened three times before. Oh, it happened a fourth time. You shouldn't be surprised when it happens over and over again.
Sure. So let me ask you a follow-up question. I know it's too early to even ask this question, but where are you taking him next year? I mean, if you have the 13th pick in a 15 team draft, will you consider taking Alvarez at 13? Do you think he goes higher than that?
So the one side of me thinks I should we should let it go, let it ride and take him. But then the other side says, well, he did it for 1 year. He's bound to get hurt again. maybe he got lucky. So I honestly don't know. I might actually pass on him. The conservative side of me might actually pass and just look elsewhere.
That's a tough question. Yeah, that's something that we'll have to debate over the winter, because I certainly think that there are some of the high stakes players in the leagues that I play in absolutely adore this guy and seem to push him up draft boards. And I get that. Yeah. I don't think I've ever rostered him. I don't think I've ever had him. I think I've always been worried about those crappy knees, and especially when he has to play in the outfield at times and whatnot. So, but he's proving us wrong maybe this year. We'll have to see how we think about that. After the dust settles on the season, we'll have some time to reflect on that.
Yeah.
And with that, let's go to our first ad break and come back with our segment on difference of opinion. Dave and I will have different opinions on things, I think, coming right up. Okay, we're back. Now, Dave, I don't know if you're just feeling more combative as you get ready to go back to work or what the story is, but I feel like you put this difference of opinion segment in to maybe try to get at me a little bit, maybe kind of get some digs at my thought processes and philosophies on things. I like it.
Never.
You would never?
I
would
never do that. I am an innocent bystander here. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to learn. That's all it is.
As you're sitting in your green room with this devilish look in your eyes. Okay. But, you know, honestly, I think one of the things that's always a great conversation in fantasy baseball circles really is that, you know, a lot of shows that we listen to, people have, they get along well, they've got great chemistry. You and I fall into that crowd as well, but we can have different opinions. And a lot of the great podcasts that I listen to, people do have different opinions, and I think that's totally okay. And it helps us grow and learn as not only humans, but also as fantasy baseball players.
And I kind of figured you and I are always on the same page for most things. I think like 90% of the things, we're always on the same page and we're always supporting each other's opinions. So I just figured this week, I know some topics that you and I disagree on. I figured let's just put it out there in the open and just maybe we can learn from it, and maybe we'll change each other's ideas. Who knows?
I love it, because it feels like people will listen to this and they'll be like, oh, that's a subtle question to ask, but it's really meant to be hurtful to me. And I appreciate that, because it's going to cost me to have existential crisis this afternoon and probably crack open a beer after I cut the grass and think about my pitching strategy, because you're making me do it. The first topic we wanted to kind of discuss here was the idea that drafting an early round starting pitcher is the best way to build a team. And I have been pretty, I guess, forward with my idea that in most leagues, I will draft a pitcher in the first three rounds.
Yes.
And your philosophy has been a little different from that. And you put together some things here that are really good food for thought, even as they sort of poke holes through my argument of trying to get a pitcher early.
Well, my philosophy is I like to wait, because I've said it here before. I think the game is tailored to help hitters and hurt pitchers, because most injuries that happen, the more serious ones I find, are to pitchers. And, you know, the act of throwing a baseball is so unnatural, especially at a high velocity, and doing it over and over at a quick rate, it's bound to cause injuries to happen. So I don't feel comfortable drafting an early round pitcher, because there, if I take him maybe in the second or third round, my guy's gone for the year, and then I'm rebuilding, and I'm not just looking for hitting on the waiver wire, but I'm looking to replace that pitching. That being said, I drafted Kyle Tucker and Jazz Chisholm with my first two picks, and I'm still looking for hitting.
Yeah, they didn't work out so well.
Yeah. Regardless, though, and keeping in mind that every year the draft pool is different, so what happened one year doesn't necessarily mean it'll happen again. But of the top 50 pitchers that were drafted, which pitchers are you happy with? So I made a list of top 50 pitchers that I would be happy with if I had drafted them. Mm-hmm. Christopher Sanchez, Yamamoto, yes. Logan Gilbert, Chris Sale, Logan Webb, Jesus Luzardo, Dylan Cease, Zach Wheeler, The Miz, Sonny Gray, and I think I'd be happy with Joe Ryan and Nolan McLean. Mm-hmm. So of those, that's 12 out of 50. However, in that top 50, there's still 18 closers that were taken. So take them out. It's 12 out of 32 pitchers that were taken. That's a 38% hit rate. Yeah. Now, I'm asking as a genuine question, do you think that's a good hit rate? That
it's not.
Okay.
It's not, but the issue is, then where are you going? Where do you get that pitching glut? So if you're going to avoid taking a top guy in those first couple of rounds, then where are you going to get that? Because then is everyone going to be searching in those the fifth round and later for starting pitching then? You know, like things in fantasy baseball tend to follow crowds, right? So what's your pivot there? If you decide to not do that, what's your pivot, you think?
Well, my pivot might be the same as what others will do, but someone will take these pitchers and they won't be pivoting like me. So they will be looking for hitters later. So I won't be against the entire draft field, but that's where I think the off-season work comes into play, is trying to find those diamonds in the rough later in the draft, or trying to find players that are undervalued and that maybe aren't being taken where they should be. And if you can identify those, then I think you're going to be okay, because there's always going to be pitchers that are taken later in the drafts that are of value, mm-hmm. or that could, I'd like to call them like league winners. That it's just, you know, players that were drafted in the top 200 that are now, you know, top guys, like a Parker Messick. You could have taken him late.
That's where I had trouble this year, and a lot of my draft strategy was I had kind of made up my mind. I wasn't crazy about the idea of going after one of the top three guys, just because I felt like that was, again, putting all your eggs in one basket, proverbially. And if that didn't work out, you were kind of screwed. And that's pretty much how it's worked out for a lot of people who drafted that big three, right? I mean, Skeens has been okay. Crochet has been out, and Scooble's been okay, but not like Scooble like across the board, right? So I had targeted Christopher Sanchez in a lot of places, and that's obviously worked out pretty well for me. Mm-hmm. But in other leagues that I was in, like in GLARF, where I was trying to employ, I'm going to try to get a two ace, like a 1A, 1B strategy, like a Joe Ryan, Dylan Cease kind of thing. That didn't really end up working out so great for me. And I feel like I my pitching, to your point, what happened in that league that was interesting is that I hit on guys later on. I had Logan Gilbert in that league, and then Ryan got hurt. But I had also drafted Rodon. I had drafted who else did I have there? Flitler. My middle round guys all produced. Nick Martinez. I've had some really good results with that stuff. But because of the fact that I lacked that true ace that I thought I was going to be getting with my strategy, it just didn't end up working out. In that league, my pitching's been pretty middle of the pack or above. It's my hitting that's been really bad. And so I can never hit the magic formula exactly right anywhere. Like my home league and stuff like that, and a couple other like specialty leagues I've done okay in, but leagues where I have to have that balance, I really failed this year. So I really think I have to look at that strategy a little bit more deeply. My biggest nagging thing for me is this gnawing internal fear that I never will have enough pitching. And so I have to really, over the winter, really think about where I can do that and be more confident in my draft strategy to know that I might be able to do some pivoting and do some different things to get to those types of guys without feeling this intense pressure to get somebody that's in the top tier. That's what happened to me in Tout, right? Yeah. All the top names are flying off the board. I wasn't comfortable with the prices. I'm like, well, I'll just pivot to Framber. Oops.
Yeah. Yeah.
Joe Musgrove will be back soon. Oops.
And that's right. The fault with, you know, my strategy is like you said, you got to scout out and figure out those diamonds in the rough, but it can be very rough. And I was in on Framber as well this year, and it didn't work out for me in those leagues because I did wait so long. So maybe I'll have to readjust that as well. And maybe maybe there's a common ground. Like, I think you're up top of where to draft, and I'm always waiting, and I know it's to a fault, but maybe somewhere a common ground in the middle for both of us might be the sweet spot to really do it. So instead of, you know, a second round pitcher, maybe if you get that guy in the third or fourth, and for me, instead of waiting 8 or 9 rounds, I'm taking someone, you know, maybe in the fifth or sixth. Maybe that's that sweet spot, like between the third and the sixth round. If you can get your ace there,
yeah,
maybe go from there.
Yeah, it's going to be really fun to watch how that's going to play out, because I play in some leagues with some pretty high line people that I'll be really kind of watching what their strategy is. And I need to do more of that in the wintertime too. Kind of a side note, like go back and look at what other people did, mm-hmm. and how they built their teams, and how I can maybe look at that and learn more from just watching what other people are doing. I need to incorporate more of that into my study.
Yeah.
Here's our second topic, and this might end our friendship. No, I'm not kidding. I mean, you can't. This is ridiculous.
Can I announce this one?
Please.
It's one of my favorites. O'Neill Cruz should be a top 75 drafted player next year with top 45 plus upside.
Oh my God.
I mean, I may have picked this one on purpose, but it is what it is. But
Next question.
Okay. In all seriousness though,
I'll listen to your testimony. You're my friend. You're my partner on the show. I have to listen. I'm going to be open to it. Go ahead.
I always felt like last year was his rock bottom. It was the worst that it could have gotten.
No.
If you could have imagined the worst, that's what it was. But he is someone who hits the ball hard and far, and that can't all be bad. He's got power. In the offseason, he worked on himself. He got lineup protection. He had the Ozuna mentorship. He also had the lowest career BABIP last season, so quite unlucky. And despite all of that, he still went 20-38. Looking this year, he's looking more like a mix between 2024 and 2025. A reminder, in 2024, he was almost a 5-category player. Mm-hmm. If this is who he is right now, I'll take it. I think there's potential here for maybe even a little step forward, maybe a little less chase, make a little more contact, take a few more walks. But he's out there hitting power. He's out there running. And if he can bump up his average or keep it where it is, I think it's what you would want, you know, at that point in the draft. Top 75 player, that's what the 5th round.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he could be a 25-35 player batting 260. Isn't that what you want at that point in the draft?
Okay. I see your argument, and you make some valid points. Mm-hmm. But he's terrible. And I'll take a lot of flack for that, and I'm sure that people will at me on Twitter or X, whatever they call it now, and that's totally fine. I shouldn't say that he's terrible. He hits the ball hard and far, Dave. That's great. But so did Steve Balboni. I can give you a long list of guys that hit the ball hard and far that weren't excellent baseball players. Here's my worry. The red looks great on the Statcast. Boy, the hard hit, it's delicious. You know, the barrel percentage, the average exit velocity. I mean, he's in the 99th 100th percentile for all of these things. But he's also in the 99th percentile for whiff percentage, which is 36.8%. He's also in the 99th percentile for strikeout percentage, which is a whopping 35.2%. Every year that he's been in the major leagues and played a full season, that strikeout percentage has gone up precipitously from the year before. To your point, he's getting on base. He's hitting lefties better this year. And I think that really ends up becoming the key for me. Is that a growth that he can continue into next year, or is this a bit of an anomaly? Do we really know? And to be really honest with you, I've not seen him play a lot this year. I also am a little interested in wondering why he's getting so many fastballs to hit when he hits fastballs pretty well. It seems to me that people should be giving him more off speed and breaking stuff because he really struggles there. Hitting the ball, especially balls that are low in the zone, he's really historically struggled against those things. Yeah. I think that you're absolutely right in one way, and I can admit my fault on this. I mean, there are a lot of things looking there. You say fifth round value. Boy, that's a really good outfielder to kind of build your offense around in fantasy, right? But if you're in the fifth round, have you already taken that type of profile? Have you already gotten that type of thing? What are you leaving on the board if you're taking a chance on O'Neal Cruz in the top 75 picks? Now, this is part of the reason why I lose, because I don't get the upside. I don't get the guys that have upside. I always end up picking safe. And you're making a compelling argument that Cruz could be a guy that's like that. But I have to be really honest with you. I just can never put my finger on exactly what this guy is and what he's going to be. Yet he's only 27. So in theory, he could be hitting that prime, and maybe this is who he is. The expected batting average is 251. Last year, he barely hit 200. He had a real rough time of it and still was a productive player. Do we care so much about batting average anymore? You know, our composite batting averages for some of the leagues that I'm in is going to be in the 240s for a lot of teams. So maybe I need to go back and take a second look at that. I'm just very predisposed against these guys who strike out a ton, because I always feel that's going to get worse and not going to get better. So I could see a scenario in which he strikes out 40% of the time coming if he's not able to keep the gains that he has this year.
The only counter that I'll say, and it goes back to Steve Balboni and everything that you've said, you have not talked about the fact that he runs.
And he does.
He hits for power. Great. If he didn't have that running ability, I wouldn't be putting him up there. But I mean, I just looked it up now. Since he came into the league in 2021, he ranks 31st in baseball of all qualified hitters for stolen bases. Uh-huh. So he's out there running. And the fact that let's assume by the end of the year he hits 255. So he goes down a few batting points. Sure. Two of the last three seasons, he'll have hit over 250 while hitting for power and speed. That's close to a five category player. And for me, if I'm getting that in the fifth round, and I know I may have drafted that earlier, but mm-hmm. to me, that's just even more balance and something that I'd be looking for at that point.
Does it worry you at all? You know, he obviously had the hand injury in July.
Yeah.
And that's not his fault. I mean, he plays an aggressive style. He's a gigantic man. He missed all of July. Since he's come back, he's hitting 233 with three home runs and one stolen base. 10 of his stolen bases came in April. 9 of those came in May of the 22 that he has right now. Is there any concern that he can't put it together over the course of a full season?
Yeah, I think there is. And he did that last year as well. He had a really good start to the season, and then he just couldn't adapt to when pitchers adapt to him. The only thing is, I would say to that is that while you are right, the end result, you're looking for the overall totals, and he still finished with 20 and 38 last year mm-hmm. while being in part of a platoon. Mm-hmm. So you're right that if he just can't adapt and he just can't keep it going through the whole season, if he ever could, I don't know what it would take to teach him to keep it going. If he ever could, I think there's such another level that he could take it to, but you're right. He hasn't been able to keep it over a long period of time. But it's the overall numbers that we're looking for, I think. So
right, and that's the thing, right? Like there are. I think part of my bias with it is that I'm writing waiver wire articles. I'm always looking at these guys and what they've done lately, Yeah. And so when I see somebody that hasn't performed as well as they had prior, obviously you're not jettisoning O'Neal Cruz off of your team. But my point in that is, are we looking more at the bottom line? Back of the baseball card totals at the end of the year, and we're satisfied? Or do we care necessarily about, a bad month when you're going to get that production on the back end of it? I guess it's probably league dependent. If you're playing in weekly leagues, yes, you care about that. If you're playing in, standard roto categories, then you probably don't really care about that much. But Cruz is a different animal. There's no doubt about it. He's extremely talented. Mm-hmm.
And to your point there too, it talks about timing in baseball, because you could have a really bad start to the season, drop, and that player could be dropped and you could pick him up, and then he could end up with, O'Neal Cruz's final stats, and you're wondering what the heck happened. When I had him, he had two home runs and three stolen bases, and now he finished with a 20-20. It's all about timing.
Agreed. Great topic, Dave. That's someone that we'll probably revisit this winter. The next one, drafting an early round closer is the clearest path to failure outside of waiting to draft your first one late in drafts. Tell me a little bit about what you feel about that.
Okay, so I'm on the side where I like getting that save stability. I like getting that early round closer, and I'm willing to pay up for it. Like we mentioned before, out of the top 50 pitchers taken, 18 of those 50 were closers. And of those, from what I saw, of those 18, only really Estevez and Hoffman, they didn't really pay out. Mm-hmm. Now, there were some injuries as well. Palencia, Hader, and Helsley, they've all been injured. But they've been good when they've been in there. So right now, how many saves do you actually need in a 15-teamer? I use this as my TGFBI argument. Right now, the leader has 93. So maybe, mm-hmm. I don't know, by the end of the year, 110 to lead. If you can get somebody who's going to get you the 30, the 35 saves, you're already far ahead of the game where you could wait a little bit more, maybe get one or two speculative closers later, and then build up and just be competitive in that category.
Yeah, this is a really fascinating question to ask, because there are leagues in which I've seen a real wide variation here in where you need to be in saves depending on the league that you're in. So you talked about your TGFBI, the leader has 93. In mine, the leader has 74.
Oh, wow.
And I have 44, and I'm in the middle of the pack in points.
Oof.
I have 44 because I have Cade Smith. who I drafted into the third round, right? Mm. I mean, to the point of the question that we're asking here. But like when I look at my Glarf team, I have 37 saves total. The league leader, I think, is Aaron Cumming, and he's got 62. So saves are – people are kind of punting the category or trying to figure out a way to kind of Frankenstein it. What I did in TGFBI worked pretty well because I had got Cade Smith, right? So he's got 35 of my 44 saves, and I've used a menagerie of other people to get there. In Glarf, my strategy did not work as well. I waited on closer, thinking that was going to be the right call because the value of closers was pushed so far up in that league. I ended up with Raisel Iglesias, which is fine. I'm totally fine with having Raisel Iglesias, but I didn't have enough to build around that. You know, like by the time I got down to the second closer tier, it was pretty slim pickings. It was, you know, Estevez, who was hurt. It was Clayton Beter, who was unsure of a job. I didn't plan that one really well, but I do think that over the winter there's going to be a lot of discussion and speculation about where to draft closers. And for me, what has worked well for me in most of the leagues I have been in is to get an early one and just let it ride and then try to build on with somebody later on. So I play in Tout Wars, as you know, and my pitching staff in Tout Wars has been an absolute disgrace. I mean, like, they probably shouldn't even ask me back to play next year because my pitching staff was so bad. And I kept trying all year to rebuild it. But the one thing I did do really well was build a bullpen. I knew that I wanted to get one of the top five guys, and John Duran was my target, and I got him. And then I knew Grant Taylor would have a job at some point doing something in that bullpen, and he's been really good. But the gem of that one was Letts. You know, I took him not knowing what the role was going to be. I knew that I liked his stuff. I knew that he could get a chance to close. I did not see the season coming. And so I've been among the league leaders in Tout Wars with saves all year. Now, what I probably should have done is taken one of those guys and tried to trade him for something else that I needed. And I did try to do that, as you know, and I'm not going to name names with who I was trying to make trades with, but could not lock in on anything that I thought was a fair price.
Yeah.
For that. So, but I think the strategy, you know, is dependent upon your league and your context, which is what I was trying to illustrate with my point there.
So from the sounds of it, we're actually on the same side on this then. We're not.
But my point is this. I think I'm on the same side right now, but I think ask me at Christmas time, because gotcha. I think my strategy overall needs an overhaul. You know what I mean? Like, it's not allowing me to win or to be super competitive. And I'm competitive in spots, but I want to be competitive all over. Right. And I think what I'm going to do this year is really narrow down. I'm in too many leagues for me to be able to keep track of it. you know, I work 6 days a week. I can't keep track of everything that I've got going on. So I think if I really hone the focus down to maybe three or four teams this year, I'll feel a lot better about that and can really kind of hone in on it. So I could see the strategy changing for me was my point.
Ah, gotcha. Okay. Maybe we'll have some therapy sessions this winter. We can both figure out how we can be better.
Yeah, in some of the leagues that I'm in, I'd be better off burning the $150 entry fee than actually playing in the league at this point, you know. So anyway, okay, last topic here, Dave. Topic number four. Players like Chandler Simpson and Xavier Edwards have real fantasy value, and their biggest asset, speed, should really bump up that value. Now, this is one that you and I have disagreed on historically, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that after you're through with what you're saying, because you've been a huge proponent of guys like this, and they go really undervalued. In many leagues that you've been successful in over the years, you've had guys like these on your team that have played major dividends for you. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, this is my wheelhouse. I love a small ball with speed. I love it when it just slap hitters get on base. Admittedly, of the two, Xavier Edwards has disappointed just a little bit. I don't see him running as often as I wish that he would and could, but he still has a low K rate and gets on base. So he's got a 286 batting average right now, 19 stolen bases. Chandler Simpson, he's well over 300 and he's got 36 now. I don't think I updated the show doc here, but I think he stole again one or two last night. But he's always looking to steal and he's really exciting to watch. Like I will tune in when he is up to bat just to see what he will do at the plate and on the base paths. And I know there were some concerns earlier in the year when, you know, he wasn't stealing, but honestly, a lot of the situations where there was a runner in front of him and he just couldn't steal. Mm-hmm. I just find that batting average and stolen bases are the toughest offensive categories to fill. You can fill home runs, great. You'll also get runs and RBIs. You hit a home run, all three of those count. Fantastic. But it's hard to get batting average and stolen bases, especially later in the year with batting average. Because it's an average and it's not a cumulative total, the sample size gets larger, so every hit doesn't have as big of an impact on your batting average. So right now in a 15-teamer, I would say, what do you need? Maybe 200 stolen bases to win? Okay. Right now, if you can get Chandler Simpson, who will maybe finish with about 40, maybe between 40 and 50 almost, you're looking at 20 to 25% of your total win just for one player. Mm-hmm. Or 30 to 35% just to compete in that category. Now, it comes with a caveat, though. Xavier Edwards was at a 174 ADP. Chandler Simpson was at 175. Those are great ADPs to help stabilize one or two categories that are tough to fill. If they get a lot higher than that, I don't think I would be in as much on them simply because it is two categories that you're filling, but I really like the value and I like what they can bring back. And I think those are really two things that you should be looking for.
What I really like about what you said, and as we've talked about this quite a bit, just in our chat, and I have always sort of discounted these types of players because I feel like I don't get enough bang for the buck and that I have to make up something elsewhere. And I don't like doing that. But you're absolutely right. What ends up happening for me when I look at it is I stockpile home runs, which means you also get RBIs, but I always struggle on batting average. And if I don't get those big stolen base producers in the first couple of rounds, like the Ellie De La Cruz's and the Bobby Witts, I almost always fall behind in that category too. And then these middle rounds, 174, 175 ADP, like you're saying, I'm usually drafting pitching in there. And I'm missing out on these types of bats that can really help me. And I think what I need to do is shift my focus a little bit. When I think about three category producers, I think about, you know, home runs, stolen bases, and batting average, right? I that's what I think about. But if you shift that thinking a little bit and move over to these really important stats that you have to have, like batting average and stolen bases and runs, which we always forget about, these guys are really valuable players to have. I mean, Xavier Edwards is a great example that you brought up. He did steal a base last night, so now he's at 20 on the season. He's only got six home runs, but he's a 280 hitter year in and year out. And that's going to stay. And that's something that you really need to be able to have on your team to counterbalance the guy that hits 230, but hits 35 home runs, right? You have to be able to strike that balance with it. And he's going to score 75 or 80 runs. You know, those are very usable statistics where you get him in the draft. And so I think I need to really strongly reconsider my thought process on this, because I end up with a ton of home runs usually, a ton of RBIs, but I'm always short on batting average every year, but short on batting average. And a little bit short on steals. Most of my teams have somewhere between 130 and 150 stolen bases, which kind of puts me in the middle. But 200, you're right, is what will win the category, which is remarkable. I need to adjust that setting too, because I didn't think I would need as many steals this year as I have.
I think I need to readjust too, because as much as I love these guys, I always find I'm still drafting balanced stat guys at the beginning of my draft anyways. And then I'm pairing them later in the draft with these players. Mm-hmm. That might be a fault too, in the sense that maybe I should draft like you are with the heavy hitters early. And then if I could pair them, you know, in the later rounds or the mid rounds, like here, if I could get Xavier Edwards and Chandler Simpson with high batting average and steals, that would counter the what I would be lacking with the power guys. Because typically power hitters hit lower batting averages just because they're trying to hit home runs. So I don't know. Maybe there's a case here for both of our strategies. It's just hit for power early, hit for batting average and speed later to balance it all out. That might be the winning formula.
I like that. Well, Dave, this is going to be something that we're going to continue to talk about during the winter, I'm sure. Fascinating conversation. Hopefully, I find it fascinating. I don't know if anybody else will, but it was a good conversation for us to have. And I think one of those things that I always want to come back to on this is that we should always be trying to learn and grow in our strategy, not only in strategy, but also in life, right? We want to be able to make sure that we're looking at our philosophies and the things that we hold to be true and constantly examining those things the same way that, you know, somebody like Socrates would want you to be constantly examining your life and what you're doing with it. So with that, let's go to our last commercial break and come back with our mental health minute. All right, Dave, we're back for our final segment. Talking a little bit about mental health moment, you know, and in this show today, it was mild, obviously, but, you know, we know that there will be disagreements in life and there will be conflict is kind of inevitable. And we're going to run across that in our lives. How do you handle disagreements that you have with other people? I mean, we know that disagreements can really kind of end up defining who we are as a human and how we recover from those things, how we challenge those things. But if we can't properly deal with conflict, you know, we can lead to some having some pretty uncomfortable situations in our lives. How do you deal with conflict and disagreements in your life?
I think conflict is important, as hard as it is to deal with sometimes, because you don't want to burn bridges. You need to find a balance of, relaying your point, not offending the other person, standing up for what you believe in, but also being able to understand that you're not going to be right all the time. And you need to listen to what the other person's saying. And then from there, you need to just figure out, have a common ground. And I think for the most part, I do listen to others. I try and take into account what's said, and I do reflect on things afterwards. I actually think a lot about, you know, conversations that I've had with people afterwards and, you know, did I handle it right? Did I say what I should have said? Did I say enough? Sometimes I feel like I'm George Costanza driving away and it's the jerk store thing. And I realize what I should have said. And I want to turn the car around and finish that conversation, but I don't. I do think I'm a better typer than talker. I do get what I want to say out when I'm typing better than I'm talking. So I am working on that. And it's weird too, because with certain people, I find I lack the patience that I need. Like just the other day, my mom and I had a huge blowout, yelling at each other. And then I think to myself, what am I doing? She's 80 plus years old. Why am I yelling at my mother here? Yeah. Like, what am I doing? Yeah. So there are moments when I do lose it and I do think about it, and you know, you've got to work to not burn, keep that bridge burned. But overall, it's just maintaining a level of dialogue, listening, understanding the points of view and then, you know, living life with, you know, based on what we both said, and we can all be happy with it and go from there.
Different kinds of conflicts come up in life, right? And there are some that come up kind of out of nowhere that we have to deal with in the moment. And we have to make sure that we have enough tools in the toolbox to be able to deal with that. But a lot of conflicts that we find ourselves in are things that have been brewing for a long time. Mm-hmm. And things that maybe kind of fly under the radar for a while, but then become a source of irritation, kind of like what you were talking about with your mom, right? I mean, I don't know what the argument was about. It's none of my business, but I can imagine, like, you know, living, your mom lives with you guys, right? And you have, I'm sure that nerves can get a little frayed from time to time, as they would in any familiar relationship. But a lot of the conflict that I deal with at work is stuff that I know is coming and that I can plan for. And I think as a guy in the world, especially me, who was well known as a younger person for having a very bad temper, I think for me, what I've had to learn over the course of time is that I have to really plan what it is that I'm going to say and script it. And so if I know that I have to have a difficult conversation with one of my staff or with one of the students here, which happens every week of my life, I have a plan that I use, that I like a template that I use to kind of plan that conversation out. Now, I know some people will say, oh, you know, who's got time to do that? Well, I don't have time to recover the loss that I create if I don't handle the conflict the right way. I just don't have time to be able to do that. So I plan it, I script it, and then I practice delivering it. I will sometimes look in a mirror. I will sometimes look to see what my facial expressions are saying. You know, the psychologists say that about 90% of all communication is nonverbal. Mm-hmm. So I'm always kind of thinking about what my nonverbals are saying, what my hands are saying, what my face says, not rolling my eyes, making good eye contact, those different things. And then when a conversation is done, this is something I do that's different from a lot of people I know. I document it. I keep kind of a running diary on my computer of the conversation, what we decided on and what the action plan is moving forward on those things, you know, because I will forget. I'm dealing with 100 different things on a daily basis. So, yeah. You know, the old saying is, you know, conflict is inevitable, but combat is optional. And most of the time, I'd rather not fight. I'd rather listen. I'd rather try to understand where the other person is coming from and then seek to be understood myself. And most of the time, I think if you follow that formula, you can be fairly successful with it. But it depends. I mean, if you and I are talking about O'Neal Cruz, I mean, all bets are off, you know.
So there's exceptions to every rule.
Exceptions to every rule. And O'Neal Cruz is my exception, you know. all right, Dave. Anything else for the good of the order here? We're wrapping up our show 21 here on Saturday morning. It's the end of August next week. You will be getting ready to go back to school. We'll be recording on Saturday. It's a Labor Day weekend here. Any words of wisdom for the audience before we get out of here?
The quote that I have this week from Joe Posnanski.
Posnanski, yeah.
Right. I never argue with people who say baseball is boring because baseball is boring. And then suddenly it isn't. And that's what makes it great.
That's funny. Yeah, he's a great writer. I have a couple of his books. I should send them to you. You would actually probably really like them. So, okay, Dave, with that, we've wrapped up show 21. It's the end of August here, getting into September. One more month of baseball. We got about 4 or 5 more shows in us before we get to the end of the season. And I'm praying that my White Sox can hold on to a playoff spot. They did beat Minnesota last night, and Cleveland lost for the first time in what seems like 2 weeks. So with that, we'll let you guys get going. Have a great weekend. Rest, recharge those batteries this weekend before you get back into it next week. And we will be back next week with episode 22 of Breakfast with the Beats. Have a great one. Take care. Peace to all of you.